Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Silicon Valley, it is home to tech giants and the hub of the next digital frontier, AI. Despite the recent economic downturn, layoffs, and the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, the tech sector continues to attract billions of dollars in investments. According to PitchBook, a business data firm, California was home to 41% of venture capital funding in the United States last year. That equals over $102 billion. But who that VC money is being invested with is the topic of a report co-published by the Fuller Project, a global newsroom that focuses on women, along with The Guardian. Their data shows that just 2% of the money being invested by venture capital firms is flowing to companies founded by all-women teams. And for women of color, that number shrinks even further. Hanisha Harjani is the reporter behind this story. Hanisha joins us to discuss the disparity in VC investing and a new state law signed by Governor Newsom with the goal to help add transparency to who VCs invest in and potentially penalize those who don't share that data. So let's start off with the Fuller Project, what it is, and how you became involved with the nonprofit newsroom.
Yeah, so the Fuller Project is a global nonprofit newsroom that produces impactful journalism on issues affecting women. I'm currently employed there as a Poynter Cook Fellow through their fellowship program, and I'm working on the California desk. So, of course, Silicon Valley has been on our radar. And the interesting thing about Silicon Valley is that it might be local to California, but its influence is ultimately global.
Yeah,
it's a huge driver of the world economy. As you mentioned, more than $100 billion in venture capital funding flowed through the state in just 2022, and Silicon Valley made up about 70% of that. So when I first heard that only 2% of venture capital funding went to all women-led teams, that was really surprising to me. But I also knew that there were so many stories in the state that could be significant in highlighting how and why.
Yeah, overall, when it comes to California and how the state likes to present itself, you know, elected leaders in the state, California comes across as a progressive state, right? And a nation leader, as a governor would say. When it comes to this type of investment, venture capital funding, just 2% of the money going to all women teams, did you get a better understanding of why that's happening in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, so I did speak to some female founders for this story, and I heard a couple of reasons why there's such little representation for women and also people of color. First, it's just, I'm sure it's not a surprise, but Silicon Valley and venture capital are really insular worlds. These female founders I spoke to, they talked about how there is just an access problem. You really need to be connected to the right people to even get your foot in the door. So the chances are really bleak for the regular person on the street with a great idea to get funded. I also got the sense that this problem is kind of just vaguely known, and VCs are saying, you know, oh, we wish we could fund more people of color or more women, but there isn't that much being done to understand what exactly the barriers to access are, and nobody's really sharing their numbers or their efforts. So I think a law like this could do a lot to remedy that.
Yeah, I mean, well, it is receiving some awareness. I mean, it bubbled up to the state legislature, and there's a bill by State Senator Nancy Skinner, a Democrat that represents Berkeley, SB 54.
Yeah, so SB 54 would require VC firms for the first time ever to disclose the demographic data of the founders they fund to the California Civil Rights Department. So this includes race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and their founders' disability and veteran status. It would apply to venture capital firms that are based in and have significant operations in the state, as well as those investing in California companies and soliciting investments from residents. So since venture capital is a huge industry in Silicon Valley, this would likely impact a lot of firms beyond Silicon Valley itself, to Wall Street and beyond. Additionally, this bill says that if companies refuse to disclose this information, it would empower the state to take these companies to court and penalize them for their noncompliance with fines. The bill also would empower the Civil Rights Department to potentially use the data provided to bring further civil action against VCs in the future as well.
Okay, so there would be accountability and consequences on the back end if they are not acting in good faith, and if that data shows that allows the state to act. On the front end, though, in terms of being proactive, what could this bill accomplish if this change isn't already happening within venture capitalist funding and who they choose to invest in?
Yeah, so this data we have access to, the numbers that we've kind of been quoting so far, that's been collected by third party sources, and it's not been collected in any formal way. So we've never had this data in any official capacity before. So even knowing the actual statistics would be huge in starting to hold VC firms accountable. By getting this official information, for the first time ever, we would finally be able to see which firms are exclusively funding white men and which firms are expanding opportunities to other communities. Some of the folks I spoke with say that public pressure could be huge in getting VC firms to diversify their funding. And the threat of potential lawsuits is also something that could really motivate change.
Yeah. You spoke with a lot of people related to the tech industry. One of them was Ellen Powell. Ellen is the founder of Project Include, which helps tech companies with increasing their diversity. So let's hear a part of what she told you about why VCs need to disclose this data.
These horrible numbers and the lack of progress and even going backwards, it's coming from individual firms making biased decisions. And it's kind of like this general problem. Everybody knows there's a problem, but nobody feels responsible for it because everybody else has like bad numbers and we're not sharing any of those bad numbers. I think people have gotten comfortable there.
Mm. What else did Ellen tell you about the challenges of increasing the level of investment in women-led companies?
Yeah. So, you know, historically, venture capital has been disproportionately white and male in both the partners at the VC firms, as well as the founders of the companies that are funded. Powell previously worked as a venture capitalist, and she was one of the very few women of color partners in that space. And she called that experience really lonely. So Powell says that there's a tendency for VC firms to continue investing in the same communities of that their partners are representing. She really highlighted this comfort that's in this space and said that it's kind of the way that things have always been in this world. And there's nothing really pushing venture capitalists to seek out diverse founders because it's going outside of what and who they know.
Mm. Okay, if I'm someone that doesn't walk in the world of tech in Silicon Valley, can you give us a sense and help us visualize how this disparity that you're laying out in venture capital funding, how it manifests in real life?
Totally. I mean, we see it on the entrepreneurial level where, you know, who gets to start companies, who gets access to building wealth, that's kind of decided by who gets funded. We see it in the products that are available in the market and whose needs are met. And especially now, you know, with artificial intelligence completely transforming the way that we live and work, there's, you know, already been a lot of reporting on the ways in which AI reproduces discrimination that we see in real life. If, for example, we're funding AI companies that are not diverse, what will that mean for our future and the problems that are prioritized in the communities that are served by this incredibly powerful technology? For this story, we actually reached out to the 10 largest firms investing in AI. That included some giants in our neighborhood, like Sequoia Capital, Andreessen Horowitz, and Soma Capital, to name a few. We asked them for their thoughts on the bill and for the demographic information of their partners and the founders that they fund. However, not one of them would talk to us.
Okay. You also spoke with Marquesa Finch, and we're going to listen to her in just a moment about her detailing the struggles of female entrepreneurs. But first, tell us about her. How did you meet her?
Yeah, so Marquesa Finch helped draft the bill, and she's been very vocal about the disparity in VC funding. She's a fintech founder herself and also a venture capitalist with a decade of experience. She's also not a stranger to the bias in these industries. She said that in the past, she's been mistaken for support staff, and that when she pitches partners at venture capital firms who are almost always white and male, they pose questions that cast doubt on her ability to lead and perform, which she says is a stark contrast to her male counterparts who are often asked questions related to growth and potential. So she's experienced this discrimination firsthand and deeply feels the need for this transparency.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to part of what she told you.
I think there's just a whole group of entrepreneurs that we're missing out on because they just can't even get in. That's where I hope we can take some of this work is really maybe in creating programs backed by our government to create nice little areas of opportunity for everybody.
Yeah. So, I mean, venture capital has been operating this way forever. There hasn't been anything holding them accountable for the way they fund. So this bill would kind of really create transparency in the industry that has historically been very, very closed off. And it could really change the face of it. Once this data becomes available, you know, in the same way that people can get sued for discrimination in housing and employment, that could be another way that VC firms are held accountable. When California's population is 50% women, when people of color make up over 60% of the state, why are we not seeing that data or anything close to it being represented in the VC world? Especially when you think about the fact that some of these VC firms are managing pension funds in the state, like CalPERS and CalSTRS. And those are some of the biggest funds in the country. And its members definitely consist of more than just 2% women. So ultimately, what this bill will do is by putting the data out there, venture capital can't deny that it has a problem anymore and kind of feign ignorance. And hopefully it will push them to change the status quo.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and we're speaking with Hanisha Harjani with the Fuller Project about a new state law that makes California the first state in the nation to require venture capital firms that they disclose the race and gender of the founders of the companies that they fund. So at the core intention of this piece of legislation is transparency, right? But there's also significant opposition to this bill, namely by the business community and advocacy groups like the California Chamber of Commerce. Can you unpack why they are opposed to this legislation?
Definitely. So the California Chamber of Commerce and TechNet wrote, and that's a national network of tech industry executives, they wrote an opposition letter together to the bill, stating their concern that the data that comes out of the bill could be used in potential future lawsuits. The National Venture Capital Association also wrote an opposition letter and stated that they were worried about the financial risk that would be created as a result of the disclosure agreement. They also wrote that the legislation was unnecessarily punitive and lacks justification.
Was it easy or difficult to get in touch with them and get their to better understand their position on this?
You know, I did reach out to them all multiple times. However, none of the organizations that opposed the bill agreed to speak with me on the record. But just, you know, reading through the comments on the bill, there's a definite sense of this legislation being seen as bureaucratic overreach. They also talk about how the data collection process that's outlined here is inefficient and would require VC firms to undertake onerous administrative responsibilities. And they also said that they don't believe that this reporting requirement will meaningfully bridge this disparity in funding that we're seeing, which they say is a priority to them, but it is unclear to me what exactly their solutions are.
As you continue to look into it, and obviously with your in-depth reporting, did you get to potentially other main reasons why they would be opposed to this bill?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there's a sense that this industry is really comfortable operating the way it has been, and this is a real change to that status quo. So I think there's a resistance to changing the way things have been, in addition to, you know, the threat of the lawsuits that could come about as a result of non-disclosure or potentially through the data that this bill produces.
And even potentially the threat of overregulation, right?
Definitely. I would say all of that. But, you know, I've also read reports from, you know, financial institutions and consulting groups that talk about the benefits of investing in minority-owned businesses. So I think there's definitely potential that the benefits of this bill go beyond just diversity. A report from 2018 showed that businesses founded by women delivered more than twice as much per dollar invested than businesses founded by men. And another report from that same year found that businesses owned by people of color are oftentimes more profitable and less risky investments.
Well, let's listen to Marquesa French on what she hopes the bill will accomplish.
Data collection around this issue will help us get a clearer picture on a number of levels. But what it also does when it becomes now California policy and then hopefully one day U.S. policy is that we can now start to build programs and other reinforcing initiatives around making sure that we do move the needle.
And honey, so you, I mean, in your report, you acknowledge this. I mean, outside of Silicon Valley, on a national level, there have been some pretty big efforts to turn back the promotion of diversity. I mean, in your reporting, you mention a recent Supreme Court ruling on school admissions, as well as a lawsuit against an advocacy group called the Fearless Fund. How does all of this relate to the topic that we're talking about?
Yeah, definitely. This bill is for sure coming at a time when there's a lot of backlash to diversity efforts across the nation. In fact, the people who helped strike down affirmative action in June are some of the very same people who are right now suing a venture capital firm in Atlanta, which you mentioned, Fearless Fund, that prioritizes funding Black women. The group pursuing this lawsuit argues that Fearless Fund's race and gender preference is illegal, though from the data that we have available, we know that Black women get less than 1% of venture capital funding. So I definitely think that this bill is coming at an important time in the national discussion around equal rights and policy. However, SB 54 is not mandating that VC firms fund in any specific ways. It's just requiring disclosure. And it's going to be really interesting to see how far just disclosure can get us. Because transparency requirements like this could put pressure on VCs to diversify without explicit quotas. So in a way, it's kind of an alternative approach.
When does the data reporting begin?
Yeah, so it would start on March 1st, 2025. And it would require VC firms to gather the demographic data of the year prior. On March 1st, 2025, and every year after that, VC firms would have to disclose that data then.
It would be the first of its kind in the country, correct?
Correct. Yeah. And again, you know, Silicon Valley makes up a huge amount of the venture capital funding in the country. So even though it is a California law, its effects would ripple far beyond that.
Mm. Finally, Hanisha, what do you hope readers take away from your reporting? Even if they're not even involved or they don't even think about Silicon Valley, even though we are all touched by it.
Definitely. I think that's a really good point. You know, even though this world may seem kind of far away and distant to some of our listeners right now, it does very much influence the everything that we see happening in our lives, especially, I think, just emphasizing how transformative AI has been. Who gets funding to create the next generation of these products and services is really going to define how we live our lives, whether or not you are in the venture capital world or the tech world. So I think even having people know about this disparity is incredibly powerful, even if you're not a part of this world. And I think it's also important to think, you know, why are some of us feeling distant from this world? And could this bill help all of us feel maybe a little bit more aware of how capital is flowing and how that is affecting our material reality?
Well, thank you for the deep dive.
Thank you for having me on.
Hanisha Harjani is a reporter with the Fuller Project discussing the lack of venture capital firm funding in Silicon Valley for women-owned or led tech companies. I talked with Hanisha last month ahead of a new state law signed by Governor Newsom that makes California the first state to require venture capital firms to disclose the race and gender of the founders of the companies that they fund. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The city of Sacramento is cautiously celebrating a win in public safety. Last week, the police department reported that violent crime is down in the city by roughly 18% overall compared to the same time last year. Sacramento police presented those findings to the city council, and during public comment, a lot of credit was given to the Office of Violence Prevention, and particularly the person who leads the department. Dr. Nicole Clavo was appointed 3 years ago, but has long and deep ties to Sacramento. She also intimately understands the pain and the toll of gun violence. Her teenage son, J.J. Clavo, was a student and an athlete at Grant Union High School. He was murdered in 2015 before the school's football game. Dr. Clavo joins us now about more what's contributing to this reduction in crime, as well as the collaborations with grassroots organizations on the ground. Joining Dr. Clavo is Mervyn Brookins, the founder of Brother to Brother Mentoring. It is one of the community-based organizations, CBOs, that works with the Office of Violence Prevention in Sacramento. Thank you both for making the time.
Thank you.
Dr. Clavo, we're going to dive into the progress that was displayed last week with the data. But first, I think it's important to understand what you came into. When you first accepted this position, you know, back in August of 2020, 3 years ago, what was your view of how the city handled and responded to violent crime?
I think they were doing a good job, but I thought it was my job to ensure that we did a better job.
You also have a doctorate in psychology. You have a master's in human services. How does that shape your approach to solutions to crime?
Well, I think it gave me a great insight because part of it was community psychology. And so understanding the community in its totality and not, you know, being that it all ties into our youth and how their upbringing and how they respond to what's going on around them.
When you stepped into the role 3 years ago, where did you see that you could make like the biggest and maybe even the quickest difference?
Ensuring that our community-based organizations, our CBOs, were working collaboratively together. So many of them were working in silos and really didn't know what each were doing. And so that we had to put a stop to that and bring them together holistically so they could work and give referrals back and forth to mm-hmm. one another and be able to help the city overall.
And one of those community-based organizations is Brother to Brother, Merv. For those who aren't familiar, I mean, you have also really deep ties to Sacramento, have made a lot of progress in the city when it comes to reducing violent crime. You know, talk to us about why you founded this organization.
Well, I think the organization was organically founded just out of the need for men in the community to step up and be involved in part of the solution. And a lot of times those that were creating the problem are not allowed to participate in the solution. So Brother to Brother is made up of an organization of men who at one time or another were on the other side of the law, learn their lessons, become productive members of society, and today they give back in whatever ways they can, whether it's mentoring, jobs, tutoring, whatever way we can find a way to allow these men to contribute, that's what we do.
Yeah, and you've joined us before on Insight. I mean, this can be like a 24/7 job. I mean, you are on call at all hours.
It is. It is. Working with the Office of Violence Prevention, whenever there's an incident, we typically are called out to respond and help with crowd control and, you know, just be a service where we can. Mm.
Given that Dr. Clavo joined the Office of Violence Prevention 3 years ago and Brother to Brother has been in Sacramento for quite some time, you know, what are the biggest changes that you saw as a community-based organization in the last year or two?
Trust. The trust that has been built over the past couple of years between law enforcement agencies and traditionally disenfranchised neighborhoods has been slowly but surely been restored. Not completely, but through the Office of Violence Prevention and the programs that it brings, there are more opportunities for officers to get involved in the community, to get to know the community, and the community to get involved and know the officers. So through that, we've been able to build up a mutual trust, and I think that's been significant in contributing towards the success mm-hmm. we've had.
When talking about 24/7, I mean, Dr. Clavo, when I was listening to last week's city council meeting, it can be, you know, a 24/7 job for you as well. Are you a one-woman department? Do you have a team with you?
There's a team of three. And so there's a team of three of us. I just recently hired my third person to my team of two. It definitely is a 24/7 job for me, not for my staff necessarily, but they work really hard. But I avail myself to all of the community-based organizations 24 hours a day. Mm.
You know, what I'm hearing from, you know, the changes that are taking place, would it be fair to say that, you know, changing the way things are done is easier said than done, right? Was there like a culture change that needed to happen or to in how the city works with organizations and people with a vested interest in making community safe with changing those silos that you were talking about?
I think we had started building relationships prior to me coming on board, right, prior to me taking this role. But I think in the midst of taking this role, we definitely had to change different areas, different perspectives. People had to get on board. We had to be like-minded, and we had to, like Merv said, learn to trust one another in all realms. Mm.
Do you think that there are misconceptions surrounding crime that you work to dismantle? You know, misconceptions surrounding who commits it, why it happens, and how to solve it?
Well, I think everyone needs to understand that crime happens everywhere, right? Some more prevalent than other areas. I believe also, you know, there's always that stigma that every shooting is gang related, which it's not. Some of it is just personal issues, personal beef. And I think that we need to understand that we all can be touched at any time, at any moment. And it's all of our responsibility to try to help stop the violence.
You know, Merv, what do you think are some of the misconceptions that need to be dismantled when it comes to crime? Who commits it, why it happens, and how to solve it?
Well, I just echo what Dr. Clavo said, that none of us are beyond the reach of crime and violence. And I think that's probably the biggest misconception, is that it doesn't have this doesn't happen in our community. As we've seen with the unfortunate shootings in downtown, the biggest mass shooting of Sacramento, that happened in an area that typically doesn't experience those type of situations. So I think when we come to understand that it can touch everyone, no matter how insulated you think you are, when everyone gets on board and understands that it can happen to you too, then I think more people will be invested in contributing to the solutions. And as far as the solutions, I don't think there's just one. The Office of Violence Prevention is we do a lot of things through the Office of Violence Prevention that's untraditional. So I don't think there's one solution. I think we just got to keep doing what we're doing.
What's an example of untraditional solutions?
Softball games between law enforcement officers and community-based, or just community. Last night we had a trunk or treat at Grant High School, and the best decorated car was the police car. So, you know, those are things that are not, it may not look like it's part of violence prevention or stopping crime, but it is, because it's creating opportunities for law enforcement to get to know the communities. The kids that at one time feared those officers, those very same officers, they see them out last night in their costumes and the police car, and they get that positive experience. That contributes towards the culture change that you spoke of earlier. So it's a lot of untraditional things that are going on that contribute to the success of the Office of Violence Prevention.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like, hearing it from you, that makes a lot of sense, because you're cultivating trust. And
yes,
especially when it comes to individuals that might not feel safe reporting a crime or calling 911. And I mean, a lot of work on the back end goes into that, Dr. Clavo. How did you create these relationships and these experiences for people who, it is a culture change. It's cultivating trust and a feeling of safety in your community with law enforcement.
Having the unfortunate experience, lived experience of being a victim of violence through my son, I knew what I needed. I knew what I wanted to see as a community member, as an activist, as an advocate. So coming into this office, I had already been engaging with a lot of the community-based organizations. I had already had an understanding of what the work they were doing and what needed to be done from my perspective. So taking that knowledge along with education and having the ability to lead this office, I just put all that into action. And
do you think that, I mean, I think about your academic experience, your professional experience, your lived experience, and how it all came together for this position to help the city of Sacramento. Do you think about that?
Oh, all the time. I my faith is really high. I have a high faith. I am a believer in God, and I believe he had been preparing me to take this role these last few years. I think it all ties in together, from the military to all of it. I think it all plays a big role on me leading this office.
Right. You were in the Navy.
Yes,
as
I
well.
Was. Yes.
You know, Merv, you're talking about with your organization, you know, being on the other side of the law and then paying it forward and helping your community. And then you have Dr. Clavo, who has her own lived experience and professional experience. How crucial is that to making a dent in violent crime in progress?
It's extremely crucial. What Dr. Clavo brings to the table is a combination of both sides. She has her lived experience. She has experience with working with CBOs, but she also has her law enforcement and military background. So to have a person in a position that understands what it takes at the grassroots level, to have a person that understands that and can communicate that to the powers that be is extremely important. Oftentimes in dealing with nonprofit work, one of the biggest challenges is finance and having resources. So having someone like Dr. Clavo who can take that message back to the powers that be and make sure that we're resourced appropriately and timely is critical. She's our voice in the room when we can't be there. And we're confident and comfortable with her being in that position.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Nicole Clavo, who leads the City of Sacramento's Office of Violence Prevention, as well as Mervin Brookins, the founder of Brother to Brother Mentoring. It's one of the community-based organizations, CBOs in the city, that works with the Office of Violence Prevention. So let's get into these numbers that were widely reported last week. There's been a more than 18% reduction in crime from January to September of this year compared to the year prior. And it is significant because the city reported more than 50 murders in each of the past 2 years. And that was the first time that that had happened since 2005. So more than 15 years ago. And that 18% drop is overall. It's higher with other crimes such as rape cases and homicides as well. When you hear these numbers and you see these findings, Merv, I mean, what do you attribute that to? There's a lot of meaning behind this data.
There's definitely a lot of meaning. I attribute it to the collaboration between law enforcement and the community-based organization. Neither one of us could do this work independent of the other. And, you know, oftentimes you go to a city council meeting or in the wake of Stephon Clark, frankly, you had a lot of community town halls where the community voiced things to change that they wanted to see within the law enforcement. Those changes are happening. Chief Lester has been implementing changes since she's been. Actually, it started with Chief Hahn, and she's continued those changes and put her own twist in it. A perfect example of that is one of the things the community wanted was more CBOs responding to mental health, unhoused situations as opposed to law enforcement because they deal with it differently. Those things are going on and they're successful. So you have on one hand the community-based organization sowing trust, building trust with law enforcement, and then you have law enforcement on the other side doing their job. And I want to be very clear because I think it goes sometimes unnoticed. Law enforcement is critical to this work. Last year alone, in Del Paso Heights itself, they took over 300 guns off the streets. Law enforcement. No one else can do that work. And when you think of that number, you can imagine the number of lives that that's actually saved. So, you know, it bothers me sometimes when I hear people talk about we don't need law enforcement, community-based organizations can do it. No, we can't. We can't do it without law enforcement, and that needs to be clear and it needs to be understood so we can move forward in conversations and continue to build upon the success that we're having.
Yeah. And Dr. Clavo, I mean, ahead of these numbers and this progress was a violent crime reduction strategy, and that was like back in June of 2022. Can you help us visualize what that looks like and how it led to these findings of having a reduction in violent crime this year?
Well, Chief came out with the violent reduction strategy as she did this year. She presented it to the council. And then last week was the update of that strategy that she put in place. Again, I guess I'd echo what Merv said. It's truly about the men and women that don their uniforms every day and the collaboration between the community-based organizations. I can't but commend and applaud the two of them and all of those that are working together to curtail all of the violence in our city. And, you know, we talk about violence, but violence isn't just gang violence. You know, it's domestic violence. It's robberies. It's, you know, violence just encapsulates that term, encapsulates a whole bunch of different type of crimes. And so I think that the strategy Chief put forward is an excellent strategy. I think we are all working hard to ensure that that strategy, it rolls out and works excellent for our residents in our city. And so with that, I believe if we all continue to work towards that same goal, we will continue to see these numbers drop.
Yeah. And with that strategy is also funding, right? I mean, you need to have money to make it happen.
Yes, correct? Very important.
Especially for organizations like yours, right, Merv?
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Because the city council also approved $3.2 million in funding for CBOs. And I believe, you know, 14 were selected. There's like two different groups. But, you know, people, we have an article and people can read all about that. You know, finally, in the last minute that we have, you know, crime touches all of us, you know, whether we want to acknowledge that or not. We're all in this. We all live in a city. We're in the city of Sacramento for this example. What do you hope people take away from this conversation about how what their role is in crime and curbing crime?
I think they need to understand that, again, this is everyone's responsibility. You know, we live in a world where times have changed, where the village is not truly the village any longer. And we need to get back to where the village is still watching out for the kid next door, the family next door, ensuring that they have food and support when we know that they don't. And maybe the mom or the dad are in the streets or once incarcerated, or maybe they're, you know, not around as much as they should be. It's our responsibility to look out for our neighbors and to ensure the safety of our youth, that they can grow up to be young adults and productive citizens in our world.
How about you, Merv?
I'd like for people to buy into the chief strategy that she's implemented. You know, you hear the words collaboration a lot. What that really looks like is every other Thursday, we have a meeting with law enforcement and community-based organizations. And this meeting is about law enforcement officers, regular officers, that refer men and women that they encounter on a daily basis to these organizations for resources and help. This is not part of their regular job. These are men and women on the force that say, hey, you know what, you may need, this organization may benefit you, here's their information, but they also give us that contact information so we can reach out. So, And what that demonstrates is that everybody is buying into the strategy. It's working. Some of the things that the community has demanded in the wake of Stephon Clark and those situations, those things are being implemented. The referral program is just one, but people need to know that the things that they demanded, the things that they requested, those things are happening.
Merv and Dr. Clavo, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Nicole Clavo leads Sacramento's Office of Violence Prevention, discussing the work that she and others are doing and the life experience that she's bringing to reduce crime in the city. Mervyn Brookins is the founder of Brother to Brother Mentoring, one of the community-based organizations that works with the Office of Violence Prevention in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Science, technology, engineering, and math, those are the tenets of STEM education. But when you add arts, you get STEAM education, which combines creativity with innovation. Learning these skills can be foundational for a student's success, both in and outside of the classroom. But equitable access remains a big issue. And many students, especially those from low-income or under-resourced communities, lack these educational opportunities. However, a Sacramento nonprofit, the Square Root Academy, is working to bridge those gaps. And this weekend, they're bringing a vibrant, free, electric art festival called 5,000 Watts to the city's Oak Park neighborhood with the goal of inspiring and supporting the next generation of innovators. Joining us is Nicholas Hastings, the executive director of Square Root Academy. Good morning.
Hey, Vicky.
When I saw electric, I almost said eclectic, but it's eclectic too, you know?
It's a little bit of both, right? It's a little mix. It's everything.
Eclectic and electric. You know, I'd love for to learn a little bit about you, your connection to Sacramento, and what got you into STEAM education?
Oh, sure. This, I'll try to keep it brief. That might be a longer answer here, but I'm from Sacramento, actually. So born and raised South Sac. I'm a Sacramento guy. I went to Sac State, where I got my degree in engineering, all that other kind of fun stuff. So it's been a ride. There are definitely deep roots and deep connections to both Sacramento and this work. Now we got started. Basically, it was me, two other engineers, and then just in our time of industry, we noticed there was a bit of a lack of diversity there. You know, whether it was an absence of women, an absence of people of color. And, you know, this was a issue not really of there being a absence of genius, but an absence of access. So we birthed Square Root Academy to address this issue kind of head on. And we've been going strong for the past 7 years to accomplish that mission.
I have to say, this is the first time I learned of STEAM education instead of STEM. And I love it because, yeah, arts are super important. Mm-hmm. I mean, and also even when you think of engineering, you need creativity for that, for math as well. How did you become acquainted with, you know, adding the A to STEM education and incorporating arts into this?
You know, I'm not going to lie to you, Vicky. It was a battle at first. Me being an engineer, I'm a bit of a purist, you know. So my thing was there's already art and math and science and all these other things. But I noticed that once we added the A in, it allowed for this to be a little more welcoming and a little more inviting for, you know, the kiddos that don't necessarily want to go the route of hard coding, but they still want to use technology to create. So we basically opened it up to STEAM, I want to say within the past kind of 3 years or so, when we really kind of started practicing more with the digital art tools, the illustrations, the animations, the video editing, et cetera, et cetera. All artistic components with kind of like a STEM nucleus in the center.
What schools and students do you typically work with?
Well, we typically work with Title I schools, you know, schools that don't necessarily always have the financial means to pay for these sorts of things. So we work with those schools, 5th through 12th grade. We teach a few hundred kiddos a week across different schools, whether it's Elk Grove Unified, Sac City Unified. And then we also teach out of our space, Lab 7 Co-working, every Saturday. So all completely free for the kiddos, just to ensure that accessibility piece. Vicky.
Yeah. And I imagine, I mean, I know this is for students who don't typically have access, or it's difficult for them to have access to this type of education and these type of opportunities. But I would think that you get a lot out of it as well.
Oh, yeah. That's the most rewarding part, is really seeing those light bulb moments with the kiddos, you know, of them like, oh, yeah, Mr. Nick, come look at what I did. Come look at this. Come look at that. So those are the moments that we really kind of do this stuff for. You know, it has its own kind of reward that comes with service, you know.
I think it builds confidence, you know, and it also opens your perspective, you know, of what's possible and what you can accomplish. And I would think that you see that, you know, firsthand on a regular basis when working with these kids.
Oh, yeah. Just kind of the change that you see in them, from these shy, timid kids to, oh, look at this, look at that, look at this thing I made. Just seeing that kind of like full 180 moment is there's no feeling like it.
And this weekend is a pretty fun excuse to learn about Square Root Academy. Talk to us about 5,000 Watts. What can people expect this weekend?
Ooh, 5,000 Watts. Oh, my goodness. So it's one of the ways that we started incorporating the A, you know. It's our Outdoor Electric STEAM Arts Festival. Dozens of giant illuminated installations. Some of them made by youth. Some of them made by experienced makers. Just imagine Burning Man, but family friendly and not in a desert, you know. So another experience, you know, it's completely free. Lots of artwork, lots of cool stuff. food trucks, fun for the whole family. You got to come check it out.
Yeah. And when you, I mean, I was just looking at photos and I mean, it is so vibrant. How do you create these pieces? Who creates these pieces?
Oh, some of them are our kiddos. You know, the one that we built in-house is, it's a combination of the kids' works that have been done, whether it's over the school year or at our Saturday programming at Lab 7. So we're really empowering the kiddos by allowing them to showcase their work here at this experience, you know. So they're actual artists that, you know, have allowed the world to kind of like see their work, or the world, Sacramento, to see their work. So yeah, that's what you can kind of expect out of this weekend a little bit here.
If this was available, I already know that you were obviously passionate about engineering. That was what you got your degree in. But if you saw this when you were a kid, what do you think it would have added to your life and to your childhood?
I mean, I would have been all on it. You know, no one in my family was an engineer before me. You know, being first gen, the exposure piece is so huge, you know. So this would have shown me like, hey, not only is tech possible, but it's possible in this way, you know. So I think that everybody has different avenues and pathways that they'll take, you know, to get to their purpose and to their work. Mm-hmm. What we are hoping to do is just exposing the kiddos to just as just another pathway and another direction that you can take your life. So I think, you know, had I had this experience, I mean, I still would have been an engineer, you know, so probably same results, but I think I would have been a lot more practiced at it at a much younger age, having been exposed to it.
What was your moment when you learned about engineering and you knew you wanted to pursue it?
Oh, see, I'm one of those rare, strange cases to where I kind of always knew. I always, since I was a child, I didn't know the word for engineer. So I was like, OK, I want to be an inventor. And then I got a little older, you know, went through my honors classes and all that in high school. And was like, oh, no, you want to be an engineer. I was like, oh, that's the word for it. So by the time I came to college here at Sac State, actually, I was a little more ready for it because I had done my homework. Yeah.
And then now you created, you know, a nonprofit, Square Root Academy, you know, and then this event on Saturday, I imagine would help the nonprofit.
Yeah. Well, it's a fun thing that we get to do, but we hope that it's a value add to the community. You know, we hope that, you know, the kiddos are enjoying, you know, the experience that we built out. I hope that the parents are learning from the tech that's brought out, you know, just showing them that, hey, this is another pathway for your kiddos. And quite honestly, this might also be another pathway for the adults and the parents as well. So we hope that they just gain exposure. We hope they have a good time. We hope they eat lots of good food. And we hope that they come hang out with us at 5000 Watts this weekend.
What has been the response from last year? I would imagine goodness. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Last year, we had about 2,000 folks sign up to attend 5,000 Watts. We actually had to block off the street this year around because the line was around the corner. So it's like, okay, let's expand it a little bit further. Let's make it bigger this year. Let's build out the street. And that's exactly what we did. So the demand's there. The people have been signing up and registering. Of course, we want more folks to come out and to come see this, but we're definitely excited from the community response we've gotten so far.
Well, Nicholas, Mr. Nick, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Vicky.
Nicholas Hastings is the executive director of the Square Root Academy. The nonprofit is behind the upcoming 5,000 Watts Electric Eclectic Art Festival taking place this Saturday at Estes Park in Sacramento's Oak Park neighborhood. We have more information on our Insight page. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Hagen. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.